What if you could do something to save someone's life but didn't know how? Would you let someone talk you through it? An Arizona program that does that is poised to go national as soon as the money turns up.
Yeah, $1.5 million is, that's a lot of money. But if you actually look at literally thousands of lives could be saved a year, it actually turns out to be an incredibly cheap public health intervention.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, telephone CPR. Also, after this week's decision by the Phoenix City Council to impose a contract, Phoenix cops plan to take their message directly to residents.
A South Phoenix neighborhood is getting a makeover.
And a West Valley city is looking to stand out.
We were looking for ways to kind of pull ourselves out from the crowd. And as Scottsdale has always had the westmost western town, Avondale needed a brand.
Plus, high schoolers digging and undergrads learning law.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Valley weather for the rest of this afternoon. Staying partly cloudy, we should warm to a high of 90. And then for this weekend, sunny skies for tomorrow with a high of 94. Coming back a little bit to 88 degrees on Sunday with some breezes. Currently under partly cloudy skies, it's 84 degrees. And a quick check of traffic. An accident you want to avoid on the 51 southbound at Cactus. That one's blocking the right lane.
In the news this hour, Arizona Senator John McCain held a town hall-style meeting with veterans earlier today to talk about allegations of mismanagement at the Phoenix VA. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and joins me now. Carrie, what did the crowd there have to say today?
The crowd was pretty full of emotion at the town hall meeting. A couple of people jumped in at the end just trying to get their point in, talking about their experience at the VA with delays or maybe a family member's. Lee Ethington was a veteran I spoke with afterwards, and his experience, he waited quite a while to get care, kind of sums up what the crowd was saying.
I'm pissed. You know, I served 7.5 years before I was injured, and, you know, I initially signed up in Vegas for the VA. No problems there. I come to Phoenix. I didn't really sign up here right away because I was young and healthy, no problems. But when I needed it, and I was promised I would have it when I needed it, they're nowhere to be found.
Lee Ethington, one of the veterans at today's town hall. What was Senator McCain's response to all that?
Well, Senator McCain was mostly listening, and he also responded quite a bit with, you know, thanks for coming out and letting me know. He did have staff there talking to the veterans afterwards, making sure that their issues were followed up on or were in the system in general. So it was mostly just to get some feedback and to let him know that he was listening.
One of the major problems, what has bred what may have been a cover-up, as you know, is this business of the length of time it takes a veteran to even be seen. And that is really the unacceptable situation.
Arizona Senator John McCain at this morning's town hall-style meeting. KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
Things got a bit testy at Wednesday's Phoenix City Council meeting as the council took the unprecedented step of imposing a contract on the city's police officer. Will Buvidas, the chief negotiator for the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, and told council members the move will change the city's political landscape.
No more will these men and women stand by while firefighters cut deals that only benefit them while screwing the cops and every other city employee. No more will they support candidates who say they stand with the cops, but that promise slowly gets forgotten the further from Election Day we go. You have succeeded on one front, and that is the sleeping giant is now wide awake, and you have ensured it will have a voice for years to come.
Phoenix's firefighters took a lot of the hits in Buvida's comments.
But the tension between Phoenix police and fire unions had been bubbling, though it had never before quite reached this level of heat. Pete Gurea, president of the United Phoenix Firefighters Association, talked about how his union felt blindsided.
Well, it really blindsided us. I mean, we saw it as a sucker punch. The wisdom of that strategy completely escapes me. I've said this before, but they got nothing for that. I mean, there was no upside to beating up on fire. It didn't produce a nickel more. I mean, they have a dangerous job. We all have dangerous jobs in the public safety. But it is what it is. I mean, that's our job. That's what we signed up for. And beating up on us, it didn't produce any more revenue. I mean, it didn't provide any additional ability for the city to give them what they wanted or not cut them. I just don't understand that at all. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me.
Is that going to hurt your collaboration going forward?
Well, I'm sure it's bound to, at least in the short term. But I can tell you the cops in the streets, they do not share that. They're coming in our fire stations all over the valley and saying, hey, man, that's not us. We're not about that. Will Bouvet is saying out there is not the way we feel. And I sent a letter out to our guys saying just exactly that. The guys in the street aren't agreeing with that type of behavior. We depend on each other. Not just out on the street, but at City Hall, and we need to make sure that we maintain the relationship and the professionalism with one another. I mean, it's vital to each other and to the citizens whom we serve. The one thing that really stood out in this was the hypocrisy from Sal DeCiso and Jim Waring. I mean, I think the cops got played by Sal and Jim. They encouraged him to come to the council. We'll support you. And I think it was just a voice themselves and get some media attention.
The option of going to the city council to resolve a union contract has always been considered almost the nuclear option, and clearly is why it's never been used before. This sort of thing doesn't happen overnight, and we've reached the conclusion that was the goal of a couple of council people.
Former city councilman Tom Simplot says tension between police and fire unions isn't new, but it was typically more hidden.
I think it was generally understood that there was some rivalry between the two with regard to perhaps political power at City Hall. And I think now that it has blown up to the extent that it has, I'm not sure how long it's going to take to repair that rift.
Well, Tom, what's going to have to happen then to repair that relationship and improve the situation?
Emotions are very raw, as we've seen in the press this week. And again, going back to the nuclear option of forcing the council to actually approve this contract, I think this was a process that was a long time coming. Number two, none of the unions would have actually elected for this process if they didn't think they might have had a better outcome going directly to the council. So when you put it in that context, the police union must have been given from somebody the belief that if they went straight to council and bypassed management and cut their own deal directly with the council, that they were going to get a better deal. And I think at the end of the day, they just couldn't get that done.
Since this was the nuclear option, how uncomfortable would you have been as a council member having to face it?
During my tenures on council, we always knew that was a possibility that we could get there. Quite frankly, I recall there being various council members over the years who were very afraid of bringing this to the council. I'm not sure there's really any fear involved in bringing this sort of thing forward. I think it's a good dialogue to have. I think it also brings transparency to the process. Having said that, 8 hours of raw emotion in a public setting, I'm not sure how productive that can be at the end of the day, especially when the union, the police union, knew that the other contracts said that they were going to get whatever deal the police union came up with. I think the council's hands were tied because of the deals that had already been struck with the other unions. So at the end of the day, I think the outcome was expected. And I think in a lot of ways, unfortunately, I think this may have repercussions, not so much on the elected officials and politicians, but sadly, I think it will have perhaps long-term negative implications for relationships between all of the working groups, all of the employee unions.
Former Phoenix City Councilman Tom Simplot.
It's never a good thing to have to make a call like this. But 911 calls in Arizona have been undergoing a bit of a change, and it requires callers to become participants.
Yes, hands in the center of his chest, right between the nipples. Put the other hand on top of that. Press down firmly with the heels of your hands. And what I want you to do is do it 50 times, 5-0, and count out loud.
The dispatcher was walking the caller through doing compression CPR on someone who was in cardiac arrest. Arizona is the first state in the country to set up a standardized process to do this. King County, Washington, where Seattle is, has been doing it for a long time as well. Dr. Ben Bobrow, the medical director for the Bureau of EMS and Trauma System at the State Department of Health Services, says it hasn't always been this way.
The public, I believe, they expect this and they want this, these life-saving instructions. But until we started this, it was not uniform that you were going to get these instructions.
Bobrow says sudden cardiac arrest is one of the top three causes of death in the U.S., and for every minute someone suffering from it doesn't receive care, their chance of survival drops by up to 10%. But Bobrow says there's a way anyone can help.
The problem is, most of the time, people don't do CPR.
Because they don't know how to do it?
They either don't know how to do it, they're not confident, they don't want to hurt someone, they're afraid. Multiple different reasons.
Bobrow says about 3 years ago, the state started training dispatchers on telling callers how to do compression CPR and making sure they all did it the same way.
There's 6.5 million people in Arizona. It would take us a long time to train everybody and get everybody to do CPR. But we probably have a few hundred 911 dispatchers. So it's a much more efficient way for us to get the treatment out to everybody is to really, really focus our efforts and attention and time on training all the dispatchers to be really good.
And Bobrow says state officials started tracking how the program was working. Did it help save lives?
We actually measure the proportion of times that they identify cardiac arrest correctly, the proportion of times they start instructions, how often they get the caller to actually do CPR, and then how long that takes. We actually measure a key time interval from call receipt to the first chest compression. And we think that that's actually one of the key performance metrics.
Is there a way to measure whether this approach has been more successful than the big public education, let's teach everybody CPR on their own?
Well, so we did have success with let's teach everybody. We had success. We actually showed that. And we're also finding the same thing with this program, where actually we've been able to measure as a state, we've decreased the time from call receipt to first chest compression by 90 seconds.
And the public health community has noticed. Bobrow says the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are looking at how to expand the program to the rest of the country.
It would be very scalable, and it wouldn't cost, you know, a significant amount of money. What we believe is that we could save thousands of lives a year across the country if we did this.
How much do you think it would cost?
Probably for the whole thing, around $1.5 million. And yeah, $1.5 million, that's a lot of money. But if you actually look at literally thousands of lives could be saved a year, it actually turns out to be an incredibly cheap public health intervention.
So just to recap, Bobrow says it had cost $1.5 million to roll this out across the country. Bobrow says the state health department has already developed a web-based training module and a data collection tool, so all that's really left to do is come up with the cash. He says the CDC is working with its foundation to try to do that.
Coming up, Phoenix's warehouse district is undergoing revitalization, but what happens to all of those old buildings?
I think for anyone who walks into this area, you can feel the difference immediately. The mass and the texture and the character of the buildings is like nowhere else in Phoenix.
More of that coming up on the show.
This is the show on KJZZ, more of our community mixed with national stories and international news, a service that blends all of the Valley, makes our world what it is. Speaking of the Valley and traffic in it, you want to avoid the 51 southbound at Cactus. An accident has the right lane blocked there. Also an accident I-10 eastbound at Buckeye that has the shoulder blocked. It'll be partly cloudy for the rest of the day. Today we're looking for a high of 90 degrees. Sunny skies over the weekend with a high of 94 tomorrow, 88 on Sunday. It's 88 degrees right now at 217.
KJZZ is supported by High Health. In celebration of Healthy Vision Month, is proud to introduce OcuCell Daily Multivitamin with added eye health nutrients. OcuCell, nourish your body, love your vision, exclusively at all High Health Valley locations.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Advice. Sometimes it's welcome and sometimes not, but people have been relying on the media to test out ideas and share stories about life's big milestones since the first printers were inked.
Talking candidly about life's big milestones is the premise behind a new podcast called Death, Sex, and Money. What do you think of those milestones? Veteran political reporter Anna Sale is the host and managing editor of the podcast, and right off the bat, she plans to put the advice spotlight right on herself.
One of the first episodes starts with a cell phone message that I got from former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson. This wasn't for radio. This was in real life because I later found out my ex-boyfriend, my then-ex-boyfriend, had reached out for help when we were split up to Alan Simpson and asked Alan Simpson to intervene in my love life.
So wait a minute. You had broken up with your boyfriend. He calls the senator.
Writes him a letter.
Right? And the senator responds.
Alan Simpson responds to me. And it opened up this really amazing relationship between my now boyfriend, we got back together through the course of this, and Alan Simpson and his wife, Anne, because they just started telling us stories about how they got through difficult moments in their relationship and in their long marriage. And it ended up really helping.
The hardest thing for all couples to talk about is sex. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to believe, but it is. Whoever is the most aggressive, the other one is in control.
Then when you talk about it, you think, well, there's a couple of horny people and want to... No, that's not the point. It's called intimacy. Scratch my back, give me a hug. I am hugging it, just a hug. I said, okay, you know. But just a touch, you know. A whack on the fanny in the kitchen.
Senator Alan Simpson.
Senator Alan Simpson.
One of a kind.
And his wife, Anne. They've been married 60 years. And the way they ended up helping me and my boyfriend was they just kept saying, look, you're not going to have it all figured out when you're making the decision to commit to one another. It's actually about just deciding that you're going to figure it out together. And it really made me think a lot about what partnership is. The other thing they talked about, which I found really fascinating, was they talked about their hard moments, and that included moments in the public eye. Alan Simpson, you'll remember, was on the Judiciary Committee, a Republican on the Judiciary Committee, back in 1991 during the Clarence Thomas hearings. And he became one of the public face of the Republican questioning of Anita Hill. And
Anita Hill, who blew the whistle on Clarence Thomas with those allegations
of sexual harassment.
That's right.
And Ann Simpson told me she didn't like how her husband was behaving.
I did tell him. You know, you all sound terrible. You sound like a bunch of male chauvinist pigs.
Finally, this built up and built up, and he was lashing back at the press because he didn't like the way he was being portrayed. And finally, she said she stepped in.
He was at home, and I said, you know, you have a wonderful reputation, the way you've always operated. And it seems to me that you are caught in something, and you just need to shut up.
Shut up.
He said, you've never said that to me before. I said, well, I am now. You know, there's a time to just recognize when you're out of control.
They have a relationship where she has permission to do that.
Where they both do. That was the thing. It was like, oh, they still have conflict in their relationship, and they talk about it openly, but there's also this deep love. And so just hearing how that actually works in a relationship, it's just nice to listen to.
So this is the magic of death, sex, and money. What is it about you that gets senators, and I guess the Pope is next, to come and unburden themselves week after week?
I got the idea for this show, John, covering elections and realizing that I was hearing these amazing American stories from voters in swing counties. Those were the only stories we were hearing about worries about family, relationships, work, the future. But these are happening in all of our lives, and that there's something actually really valuable about pausing and taking some time to listen to what other people are going through and how they're navigating through.
So everyone's going to want to know every couple of weeks how you and your boyfriend are doing now after you did this.
I know.
Realize what you've done.
And you know, John, Alan and Simpson also want to know. They keep up on us. They check in. We are doing just fine, thanks in large part to their help and their willingness to get involved.
Death, Sex, and Money. Host and managing editor, Anna Sale.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
You may have noticed more activity and foot traffic just south of downtown lately. Construction sounds or ASU students toting artwork up and down the street. That's because there's a fair amount of redevelopment happening in Phoenix's Warehouse District. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has more.
It's easy to miss. Not far from the sporty, artsy, touristy urban core is a concentration of old buildings, known as the Warehouse District. Most of the buildings here are exactly what you'd expect. Big, empty boxes, exposed beams and columns. That distinct smell of heat mixed with old wood and machinery. The area where I am now was once at the center of Phoenix commerce, home to thriving businesses in manufacturing, retail, even groceries and produce. Now, after years of disuse and blight, the neighborhood is a shell of its former self. But there are some who believe the Warehouse District can be restored.
I think these buildings inspire, and I think that's why people want to be in these buildings. That's just the simple line. The cool factor and the inspiration.
That's Michael Levine. He's a local developer who owns several buildings and businesses here. But Levine differs from many developers. He takes a hard stance on preservation.
You have to save every building, no matter how ugly it is.
That's right. Levine believes in saving all the old warehouses. That may be hard to understand. Of all the buildings in Phoenix to care about, why warehouses? Jennifer Bocek is the director of the nonprofit Preserve Phoenix, and she feels a special connection to these rough around the edges industrial spaces.
I think for anyone who walks into this area, you can feel the difference immediately. The mass and the texture and the character of the buildings is like nowhere else in Phoenix. And Phoenix needs that sense of history and character to give it a more urban feel.
In fact, this area and the neighborhoods surrounding it have historically been Latino barrios, so it's easy to see the new redevelopment as gentrification. While there are almost no residential buildings in the Warehouse District, the changes happening here are attracting young people with some disposable income, which could put the history of the neighborhood's culture at risk. But bringing fresh ideas and activity to the area is something that Levine thrives on. His more well-known projects include the building that is now the Deuce, a restaurant and boxing gym, and Levine Machine, an art studio and gallery. I went with him to one of his buildings near First Street and Madison.
The space we're in is the 1946 Phoenix Merchandise Mart. It was like an early version of a Best Buy, where you'd come in and see the couches or the TVs, and then you would be able to order it and or take it with you right then and there.
The first floor of this building has a corrugated steel roof. The I-beams are exposed. Plaster is peeling off the walls. But Levine sees new possibility.
My plans for the Phoenix Merchandise Mart are my plans that I had for all my other buildings. Strip it down to its bare bones, get a good electrical service in it, get the restrooms in it, and then it's Kevin Costner, build it and they'll come.
For Levine and Bocek, the name of the game is adaptive reuse. That means taking old buildings, renovating them, and finding new uses, rather than demolishing them and building new ones.
When I could find out who lived and breathed and cried and died in these buildings, it inspires you to work that much harder for those people, and it also can inform architecturally how you walk through the buildings and how you experience the buildings.
Levine says it's actually cheaper to renovate, but he also says that the job isn't easy. He's found all sorts of disgusting things while renovating. Pigeon skeletons and packs of beer that are a decade old. Still, Levine insists that it's necessary to preserve what's left of the historic and urban feel.
Everyone else still has their typical business thing, like, well, you have to break a couple eggs to make an omelet. There's no more eggs to be broken. You need all the continuity and connectivity that is existing to keep it moving forward.
There are 27 buildings in the area listed on the historic registry, though there are many more that Levine and Preserve Phoenix see as valuable. Jennifer Bocek is constantly keeping track of potential demolitions of these old buildings.
We try to see what we can do to step in and prevent any irreparable harm to those structures.
The thing most everyone can agree on is reviving the area. It's just a question of how. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Miro Chun, and I'm baking this morning at Lux. I usually do the doughs of the croissant dough and the puff pastry. I'm going to be making puff pastry a little later on. likes a lot of kind of Americana kind of baking. I would say that they're very community-driven. The food that ends up being baked and cooked reflects that. Things that are, you know, somewhat familiar. You get to meet the people that you're making the food for, which is pretty interesting. I think it's one of those things that's kind of hard at first because you're so much in the public eye. I think of it as kind of a solitary pursuit because, you know, you're working on creating something, but they've kind of, you know, reversed things here by making it such a public thing.
That's Miro Chun baking at Lux Central in Central Phoenix. If you hear things that make Phoenix unique or have a suggestion for Sounds of the City, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
You're only as old as you feel, right? For commentator Karina Bland, it's about attitude.
I recently celebrated a birthday, and everything went as I demanded. I mean planned. That morning, someone brought me a venti hot coffee with half and half and one Splenda. By 1 p.m., I was eating bruschetta at Postino with girlfriends, holding my wine glass in just the right way so that people would notice my nails, done professionally for the first time in more than a decade. I turned 49, after all. This is the last year I can say I'm in my 40s, and then it's the big 5-0. Here's the rub. I don't feel 49. Most of the time, I think I'm like 28. Okay, maybe 30, max. And 30 was a good year for me. True, turning the classically traumatic 3-0 meant I had missed self-imposed deadlines for getting married and becoming a millionaire, but I was happy, working at a job I loved, living in an upstairs apartment in an old house on Mill Avenue, and learning to play the guitar. My teacher would eventually suggest I take karate instead. 40 found me swimming with wild dolphins off Mount Maunganui in New Zealand, my 5-year-old son clinging to my wetsuit. And in what seemed like no time, I was marking 46 with Mexican food and margaritas, and 47 with Mexican food and margaritas, and 48 with Mexican food and margaritas. Now I'm 49, closing in on 50, and it just doesn't seem that old. I've always heard people say age is just a number, but I figured they were saying that because they were old. If I say I'm 49, everyone knows that at various times in my life, I pretended to be one of Charlie's Angels, wore an Izod polo with penny loafers, listened to Bon Jovi, and cut my hair like Jennifer Aniston. 49 tells you that I shop at Target, have the hots for George Clooney, and likely am premenopausal and shouldn't be crossed. I do think all of my son's teachers look like they're teenagers. My knees make these weird cracking noises when I crouch, and I carry a pack of tissues in my purse even when I'm not sick. Sometimes I catch a glimpse of myself in a mirror and think, wait, who is that? It's me, of course, but not the fresh-faced, wrinkle-free, perky-breasted version of me that I hold in my head. Really, I should have worn more sunscreen and a better bra. Maybe it is having a child that keeps me feeling young. I like having someone to play with. Recently, when I was making my 9th-grade son's lunch, I scrawled a note on his napkin. I see my assassin's attempt has failed. Have a nice day. XOXO, Mom. Sawyer thought it was funny, but he didn't think it was so funny when I picked him up after school, and every time he started to toss his backpack into the car, I rolled forward a foot. Of course, I was howling. Sawyer got into the car, shaking his head. Mom, when are you going to grow up? I don't know. I did think I would feel a bit more grown up this close to 50. More grounded, maybe. I imagined that with age would come a mature decorum, an automatic air of wisdom. Instead, I got skin tags. And not all of the answers. I've stopped trying to be perfect. I've come to appreciate good support, both in undergarments and friends. And I've learned the only constant thing is change. I find I care less about what others think about me and more about the kind of person I am. And I've learned if you really want something for your birthday, you should ask for it. Thus the coffee, manicure, wine, and bruschetta. Maybe I am a little wiser. And George Clooney is 52, you know.
Karina Bland writes the column, My So-Called Midlife, for the Arizona Republic.
The debate over immigration reform comes to the Valley this weekend, courtesy of filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas.
my question to people in Phoenix, where do you stand on this issue? You don't have to be Latino, you don't have to be Asian to care about immigrant rights and to worry about the kind of suffering that's happening every day all around you.
A conversation about the movie documented coming up. It's the show.
Good afternoon. The show is a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and even international news. Locally, as far as weather is concerned, we'll stay partly cloudy this afternoon, looking for a high temperature around 90 degrees. And then for this weekend, we'll warm up a bit tomorrow to 94, then sunny and breezy for Mother's Day, look for a high of 88 degrees. Quick check of Valley traffic. There's an accident on the 101 eastbound at 51st Avenue at the exit ramp.
KJZZ is supported by the San Francisco Jazz Festival, starting June 11th, featuring Diane Reeves, the Afro-Cuban All-Stars, and Jose James and the Pacific Mambo Orchestra. More information at sfjazz.org.
U of A is trying something new starting in the fall, an undergraduate degree in law. The university says it'll be the first of its kind in the country at a major research university. The program will be run through the U of A's Law School and the School of Government and Public Policy. Brent White is Associate Dean at the university's James E. Rogers College of Law.
An undergraduate degree responds to structural changes in the market for legal services, changes that have been taking place for quite some time. But the idea is that there are lots of professions for which legal training is useful given the extent to which law and regulation affect those professions, and lots of legal services that are in fact provided by non-lawyers. And so there's a clear need to provide legal education to a broader range of individuals than just those who are able to attend law school.
Do you envision that most or if not all of the students who end up getting this degree will ultimately go to law school?
No, not at all. In fact, we expect that most who get the degree won't go to law school. The idea is that this will prepare people for careers in which legal training is useful, but for which a JD is not required. Of course, the degree would serve those well who decide to go to law school, but for the vast majority of students, we expect will use their legal training to pursue a wide range of careers for which legal training is useful, but for which they don't need a JD.
Like what?
Corporate compliance, contract administration, city planning, health administration, business management, policy analyst. There are just a huge number of careers for which legal training is useful, but for which one does not need a law license.
Are those jobs in general now currently filled by folks who do have a law license?
Some are. And for the most part, there aren't. I mean, they're filled by people who don't have legal training because so much legal work is done by lawyers, and so many people are in professions that are law-related but for which they don't have legal training. So the question is really whether or not people doing law-related work are going to have access to legal training. And so for the most part, these jobs aren't done by people who have JDs.
Is there any concern that for some students who get this undergraduate law degree that they might be able to take jobs that in some cases companies might have been consulting with lawyers or working with lawyers either in-house or just sort of contract lawyers or with a firm that with whom they work, that instead of working with some of those lawyers, the firms and companies will now just work with the students who have the undergraduate degree, in a sense sort of cutting some lawyers who have gone through the JD program out of some of the work?
I mean, I think the reality is that law firms and businesses are already working with people who don't have law degrees to get a lot of legal services. And so this is responding to the reality of the market for legal services.
Brent White is Associate Dean at the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. Avondale Mayor Marie Lopez Rogers last night unveiled the West Valley City's new logo and brand as part of her State of the City address. Jeff Fairman with Avondale's Economic Development Department says it's an effort to give the city its own identity.
One of the concerns that we've had for a long time, and we hear it from
residents and developers is that as you're going around any part of the valley, east or west, it's really kind of hard to tell whether you're in one community or the other. And so we were looking for ways to kind of pull ourselves out from the crowd. And as Scottsdale has always had the westmost western town, Avondale needed a brand. So working with the city council, staff decided that rather than just do something simple like, you know, have high school kids do a new logo, we wanted to have something that had real meaning.
And what is it?
The city of Avondale is now represented by a very special designed A. It's an A that's very recognizable, an A that will be on all of our street signs. It'll be on all of our logos. And that A really stands for three things in particular. Actually, there are four A's if you think about it. One, it stands for Avondale. But more importantly, it stands for aspiring, achieving, accelerating.
Given that Avondale is one of many cities in this community, do you think that will really set yourselves apart?
We think that's a very good first step to do that. We know that just putting together a logo and adding three words to it is not going to make us any different, but you'd be amazed what we've been able to find out through the research. We found out things that, quite frankly, even us as staff didn't know.
Like what?
The makeup of our community. I was very impressed. I mean, over 25% of our surveys went to outside of Avondale, and the vast majority of them came back with they thought of Avondale as young, diverse, and techie. And quite frankly, a lot of us who live here and work here really more thought of it as a little more blue collar and a little more of a bedroom community.
How challenging is it in a community like this to basically brand yourself when you have, frankly, bigger cities and more well-known cities like Phoenix, Glendale, Tempe, Mesa, Scottsdale, places like that?
It's not easy. I think it's the best way to put it. You know, trying to differentiate ourselves, and I don't want to make us different. That's not the intent. The intent is to give us our own identity that people can relate to.
Jeff Fairman is with Avondale's Economic Development Department.
That city's effort to come up with a new brand got us thinking about branding the rest of the valley. It's a big area with a lot of people and a lot of different things it's known for.
To walk us through that, we spoke with Paula Satow. She's the founder and CEO of Satow Strategies, which is a Scottsdale-based brand marketing agency.
One of the challenges with branding Phoenix or any great city is that there's so many facets and elements and so many disparate communities that it, in a sense, goes against the grain of what you're trying to do when you're branding something, which is to coalesce all these elements and bring them together instead of disparate elements such as the Old West or resort town or all, you know, the new Silicon Valley or whatever. You bring them under a brand umbrella. We often talk about the Phoenix area, for instance, as Valley of the Suns. And Valley of the Sun is a wonderful sort of high-level, almost intangible story, much like New York talks about themselves as New York State of Mind.
So you think there's a way to sort of give Phoenix a brand that incorporates all of those disparate things, the Old West, resorts, golf, sports, high tech, all the stuff that's going on here under one brand?
Absolutely. That's what's so exciting about it, is the idea that you can come up with an umbrella, what we call an umbrella brand, that encompasses all these other elements. And so, for instance, let's just say we said we want to keep it with Valley of the Sun, but maybe we want to relaunch. This could be one strategy, that one approach I could take. Let's relaunch or reposition what we mean by Valley of the Sun and talk about it in terms of some key elements that everybody understands, maybe create an exciting new logo for that, that everybody can get behind. And the tech sector can say, yeah, we're part of Valley of the Sun, the new Valley of the Sun. And the resort community could say that, and the golf community and sports and all these other facets. And I love thinking about it. I've actually given some thought to some other ideas besides just repurposing Valley of the Sun.
Can I ask you what those are?
Sure. So maybe Phoenix, Endless Possibilities, or Discover Phoenix, Discover Yourself. Other ideas, year-round amazing. Or something related to Valley of the Sun, but maybe re-spinning it a little, like Sun Culture.
Is it harder to create a brand, or is it even desirable to create a brand for a region like the Phoenix metro area when so many of the individual cities kind of are working on their own individual brands?
That is a great point. In business, we call that brand, the umbrella brand or the corporate brand, and sub-brands. And you always want your sub-brands or your product brands to fit under or nicely synergize with the umbrella brand. You want the umbrella brand to inspire them and to be an organizing principle, and you want the other brands to be proof points for the fact that that brand stands for something wonderful, whatever that happens to be.
Paula Santow is the founder and CEO of Scottsdale-based Santow Strategies. For another perspective, we turn to Mike Denning. He's a professor in the marketing department at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU, and he's cool with sticking with Valley of the Sun.
A brand is the promise of an experience, meaning that if I see the brand or the symbolic representation of a brand, whether it's a logo or a slogan or a tagline or name of a product or a city, then immediately I associate some kind of an experience or expectation of an experience with that brand. And if I'm wrong about that, if, in other words, if there's a gap between what I expect and what I receive in that experience, then you have a negative kind of brand equity going on. On the other hand, if it's positive, it builds the brand image up, and it's more attractive, therefore, to other people.
So what do you do in a case like the Phoenix areas where you have certain things that the area is known for that are kind of contradictory? For example, you have the Old West image versus like a new high-tech kind of image.
Well, again, it depends upon what the city fathers want or the community decides it wants to be. It's not necessarily contradictory to have both a relaxed leisure atmosphere kind of experience and at the same time being able to provide employment to other people.
Do you think that the Phoenix area does a good job of branding itself?
Well, think about it this way. New Orleans is known as the Big Easy. New York City is known as the Big Apple. And we're known as the Valley of the Sun. And if you go to the San Jose Peninsula area in San Francisco, you're in Silicon Valley. Do any or all of those tell you what to expect when you go there? I mean, Phoenix has been a resort destination or a retirement destination forever. And it's very attractive, therefore, to people coming from the snow belts, the colder parts of the country, who want a more outdoor kind of life. So the Valley of the Sun kind of describes that.
Mike Denning is a professor in the marketing department at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of experts work together to focus on you. Learn which health plans include Mayo Clinic, or you can request an appointment at mayoclinic.org/Arizona.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist.
I'm going to tell you something that I haven't told a lot of people. I'm actually an undocumented immigrant.
People who have come here illegally should not be citizens of the United States.
Are you planning on deporting me? I mean, yeah, I'm undocumented.
Supporters of immigration reform talk a lot about getting undocumented immigrants out of the shadows. Award-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas did that on his own in the New York Times Magazine when he wrote that his mother had sent him from the Philippines to live in the U.S. with his grandparents, who were naturalized U.S. citizens. But Vargas himself didn't have the proper papers, which he didn't learn until he turned 16 and tried to get a driver's license. Vargas tells his story and shares others' views on reform in the film Documented, a film by an undocumented American. The film opens today at the Valley Art Theater in Tempe. Jose, when you came out as undocumented, was that just an emotional, personal choice, or did you do that with the hopes that it would change hearts and minds around the country?
It was definitely the riskiest decision I'd ever made, just because it meant, you know, it impacted everything. Professionally, personally, as somebody who's, I guess, outed myself out of two closets now, you know, I came out as gay when I was in high school and then took me, 12 years to come out of this immigration closet. The closet is a very delusional, painful thing. It creates a different system of reality for yourself, right? In which you lie to your friends, you lie to yourself, you lie to the government.
Why was it important to have Arizona, to have Phoenix be one of the first places to get to see your film?
In many ways, Arizona is the new Alabama. Arizona is the Alabama of the immigrant rights movement, with Joe Arpaio, with the governor Jan Brewer, with just the level of pain, the level of struggle, and also just the lack of immigrant rights as civil rights. This is one of the most defining civil rights movements of our time. And my question to people in Phoenix, where do you stand on this issue? You don't have to be Latino. You don't have to be Asian to care about immigrant rights and to worry about the kind of suffering that's happening every day all around you. How do we get white Arizonians and black Arizonians talking about this issue.
But you're painting with a pretty broad brush. What about the thousands of Arizonans who are sensitive to the real people affected by this and who support real immigration reform?
If you study every civil rights movement of the past just 50 years, 60 years in America, right, the black civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, the LGBT rights movement, allies are desperately needed that advocate for the full humanity and dignity of their undocumented neighbors, co-workers. I call it the Willing Grace effect. Willing Grace was really a cultural touchstone in the LGBT community because it told people that for every will, there's a grace. The same can be said, especially in Arizona, of undocumented people. For every undocumented person, there's the teacher, there's the neighbor, there's the churchgoer, there's a friend, there's the lover, there's the relative of undocumented person who advocates for that person. What do you want the undocumented young Arizonians to do? We can't all mow your lawns and babysit your kids and serve you drinks.
What should Congress be doing? Are you still frustrated, or can you say to yourself, what can I do to make them act?
As a gay, undocumented, Filipino-American who looks Asian with a Latino name, I am almost used to politics playing football with my life. The problem that we have with this immigrant rights, civil rights movement is, for the most part, we are stuck in this political mindset. You cannot change politics unless you change culture. So long as people think that these mothers and these fathers crossing the deserts to come to the United States, that they're criminals, we haven't changed the culture.
Jose Antonio Vargas, his film Documented, a film by an undocumented American, opens today at the Valley Art Theater in Tempe. It'll be there for a week, and Vargas will be at all the screenings on Sunday.
High school students in a unique program will be taking a unique field trip next week. Since March, Rob Gay has been teaching a class on paleontology at Mission Heights Preparatory High School in Casa Grande. He says as far as he can tell, it's the only program of its kind at a public high school. And a week from today, his 27 students will be heading to Utah for the weekend for a dig.
My students have been working on preparing fossil specimens that we have in our collections. They have been working on reading geological maps to figure out where to go look for fossils, and we have a permit from the Bureau of Land Management in Utah to look for and collect fossils in Utah.
So why start a paleontology program in a high school?
Well, part of it is from my training. That's what I've done for many, many years. And also because I feel it's a good way to get students into science in a real-world way. Instead of just learning from a textbook, the students are doing all sorts of hands-on work, such as preparing the fossils, coming up with conservation plans, working with actual materials, and getting to see how actual scientists perform science.
So what are you going to be looking for when you go up to Utah?
We're going to be looking in the Chinle Formation, which is late Triassic in age. So this is just about the dawn of the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were first coming out into the scene. And this is the same layer of rocks that's exposed in the petrified forest here in Arizona. So we're looking to see what sort of environments these organisms were living in. I've been doing work with some folks in Utah nearby for the last 5 years or so, and so I'm hoping to be able to get my students up there and investigate relationships between fossils we find in Arizona in the Chinle Formation and the fossils we've been finding further north in Utah in the Chinle Formation.
What do you think it is about paleontology that can sort of serve as a gateway to other sciences?
Well, it triggers the students. Growing up, all these students, they were exposed to dinosaurs in one way or another, whether it was Jurassic Park or whether it was the Ice Age movies, are exposed to these prehistoric creatures, including dinosaurs, and they have this interest in it. And for most young adults, by the time that they are teenagers, it's not cool to be into science, but they still are kind of interested. They just don't want to express it. And so I can take that hidden love of these ancient animals, these strange creatures, and I can talk about the biology, how we know certain things about their biology. We can talk about ecology. We can talk about geology, studying the rocks that they are found in. We can talk about chemistry, how we know what color some of these animals were. We can even talk about genetics, because there's work ongoing right now to try to bring back some of these extinct animals. So it allows us to talk about a wide range of interesting concepts in science using something that they are already into.
Rob Gay is a paleontologist and teaches a class on the subject at Mission Heights Preparatory High School in Casa Grande.
A new species of dinosaur has been discovered by scientists. The skeleton of the ferocious carnivore, a cousin of Tyrannosaurus rex, was dug up in southern China. Most of the attention so far has been focused on the dinosaur's unusual appearance. It's been nicknamed Pinocchio rex, the BBC's John Brain reports.
You wait 66 million years to be rediscovered, and when you are, all anybody wants to talk about is how big your nose is. Step forward Shenzhosaurus incensis, nicknamed Pinocchio on account of what scientists say is an unusually long snout. Remains of the dinosaur's skull were found by workmen on a construction site in southern China. Paleontologists at Edinburgh University examined them and identified a previously unknown species. Dr. Steve Brassate says despite its comical appearance, the dinosaur would have been a dangerous predator.
It would have looked funny with these little horns sticking out basically from its nose, but it would have been a deadly animal. This guy would have been 8 or 9 meters long, weighed about a ton. You would have wanted to avoid it.
The Shenzhosaurus is believed to have lived alongside its distant relative, the bigger and even more fearsome Tyrannosaurus rex. Perhaps fortunately for both, they would have hunted different prey.
That's the BBC's John Brain. Dozens of locations throughout Arizona have been used as a backdrop to Hollywood films.
But a particularly iconic one captures the Phoenix skyline.
KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
The Barrister Place building is a prominent structure in downtown Phoenix. It opened in 1915. It's one of the older buildings in the area. Did you know Barrister Place is the building used in the opening scene of Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 film Psycho?
The film opens with a panning, and it's a panning of what Phoenix looked like in 1960.
David Foster is an ASU professor who teaches courses on Phoenix culture. He's authored a book titled Glimpses of Phoenix.
And then the camera fades to a lover's tryst that is taking place in a hotel room, and the camera focuses in on the hotel room, and the building that is used for that location is what is today Barrister Place.
It sits on the corner of Central Avenue and Jefferson Street. Just one block west is the Lewis Tower. That, too, is part of the film. The building is seen in the background of an office front window. Actually, for the first 12 minutes of the film, Phoenix and its desert skyline is where the film is set.
It is one of the most memorable utilizations of Phoenix in filmmaking.
From the moment the film fades up from black, we clearly see Camelback Mountain, the Westward Ho, skyscrapers, city streets, and South Mountain. Foster says this film is unique because there are so few images that exist today that show the Phoenix skyline from that time.
I have spent a lot of time looking at old photographs of Phoenix, which are hard to come by the way, and I have found no similar photograph of that opening pan.
The Phoenix segment ends with another view of the city. Janet Leigh's character heads off to California, driving down Central Avenue.
I don't think we have yet a film in which Phoenix as an interesting locale or Phoenix as a socio-historic locale exists, at least not in terms of mainline filmmaking.
The Barrister Place building is owned by the city of Phoenix. It's been vacant since 2010. Phoenix hopes to have an investor revive the historic structure. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
We always want to know what you know and think. Send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
And we are on Wildfire Watch northwest of the valley, and this fire, it exploded over
down the road a little ways here. You can see some of the crew members where they're set up.
This fire has grown to 800 acres with
it was
snow.
The wildfire that took lives and left homes destroyed last June in the towns of Yarnell and Peoples Valley. The Yarnell Hill fire left about a third of Yarnell residents without a place to live. Rebuilding efforts are still ongoing, but that won't stop the town from celebrating this weekend.
It's time for Yarnell Days, the annual festival the town holds each year in May. This year's festival will be familiar: ice cream, a parade, live music, but also different. Jerry Florman is chair of Yarnell Days. She says the focus this year is on celebrating the volunteers and workers who have helped rebuild the community after the fire.
So we have invited as many of them as we can contact to come back to Yarnell to march in the parade.
She says organizers are expecting a huge crowd, bigger than Yarnell Days has ever had. The town is less than 10 square miles in size, but the fire put it on the map and in the media.
Chuck Tidy is president of the Yarnell People's Valley Chamber of Commerce and chair of the Yarnell Hill Recovery Group Steering Committee. He says the festival will give outsiders a look at how far Yarnell has come in almost a year. The fire destroyed more than 120 homes and residents evacuated for 10 days.
About 200 of our residents came back to nothing but ashes.
Since then, the recovery group has worked to raise money and rebuild. It started with the 10 uninsured homes, all of which have been rebuilt. The plan is to finish 30 underinsured homes by the end of the year. Tidy says volunteers planted 92 trees last month, and new growth is starting to cover the charred ground.
We're going to be the newest old town in the Southwest.
In some ways, the town isn't rebuilding. It's building something totally new. The town will soon have a doctor's office and hopefully a bank, things it didn't have before the fire. Of course, there's still a long way to go. Again, Jerry Florman.
As people who have suffered a severe trauma in the past year, they're still processing and dealing with trauma. It's not done yet.
But at least this Saturday, the town can celebrate the way it has for the past 45 years, since the first Yarnell Days in 1969. If you're wondering what to do this weekend, might want to try what Mark and I do, which is rock, paper, scissors. It happens to be a tournament on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Mark Apartments in Tempe. It's a rock, paper, scissors tournament for full-time students, and the winner gets a year of free rent.
That is really, really amazing. You can also check out Dave Coulier. You might remember him from Full House. He was Uncle Joey, I think, on Full House. He'll be performing his stand-up at the Tempe Improv Comedy Theater. Maybe he'll do his well-known catchphrase, cut it out.
And no word on whether John Stamos and the Olsen twins are going to be
there. I don't know that they will, and I'm embarrassed about how much I know about Dave Coulier.
And then this weekend, there's a peach festival at Schneff Farms in Queen Creek. It's have the largest peach grower in the state, while including hay rides to the orchards, Mark, and of course, live music and train rides.
Lots of Mother's Day events around the valley as well. There's one in downtown Glendale. There's a Mother's Day cupcake class that's at the Foothills Recreation and Aquatic Center. If you live in town with your mom, give her a hug on Sunday. She'll appreciate that.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez. We'll hear from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor, our managing editor, Al Macias, news director, Peter O'Dowd, and the executive producer is the incomparable John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. If you have pictures of you giving your mom a hug on Mother's Day, that's cool too. The show at KJZZ.org.
This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great weekend. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.